Paper 12, section 4, which is old single column, page 133. Okay, so first of all, everyone try to let go of all your stray thoughts of the week, because you're going to need the full powers of focus this evening. It's not a super intense section, but it'll take us the whole time to do this one section. I'm sure. There's quite a bit of very intriguing stuff in here, and so besides that. That basic encouragement to really try to focus yourself in. The title of this section, in particular, notice the title of the next section. The next section is Space and Time, okay, which is sort of the thing that rolls off of everyone's tongue. No one says space and motion. This is a typical pattern the Revelators use. They'll have a portion of their presentation that is along the lines of, so you tend to think of things like this. Okay, and that's obviously the section Space and Time. Before that, there's Revelation. That here's how you've tended to think about it. That's always a very evolutional attempt to better coordinate what they expect you to have some sort of a handle on, and to try to tweak it to inject elements into that that. Get you to take that first step out of where you are. So you think about things like this. Have you ever thought about thinking about it like this? And it usually just stops at that that suggestion of taking your picture and, say, rotating it or something and looking at it like that. But prior to that, this pattern of giving you something very direct, of a revelatory fashion. And one of the biggest things in the contrast between these two sections, Space and Time is your individuality viewpoint to a large degree. The tendency to understand things, rationalize things with those kind of two fundamental elements. Space and motion is fundamentally a top-down perspective. A unity perspective. Most fundamentally, the fact that is motion of the type that they're pointing to here. By that, they don't mean motion of a thing. They mean fundamentally motion. Motion where it's a universe of motion, not a universe of things that are in motion, but a universe of motion. And that which we tend to call things is a motion that is localized in some fashion, and can tend to take on an object-like manifestation. Well, there's just a rock, and that can but really that rock is nothing but motion, and not even in the sense of 20th century. It's like, oh yeah, I know that there's atoms and electrons are, no, not that crude type of motion. I mean, literally motion. There is no, little static things. The only static thing in the universe is the aisle. Everything else is in motion. There are no static particles. There's only motions. It's all built out of automatons, and automatons have three properties, three motions, period. There are three, we're not going to get into those details. That's on paper 42. But, they say an automaton has three properties, three motions, and then they list these three different motions, one of which is an axial revolution, quote unquote, as they describe it. And we'll see that right away when we start out here. But just so this total it's basically 180 degree reorientation, our attempt to reorient our view of the physical universe that we exist in, that it's a universe of motion. And this deep philosophical question then of what of motion? Most fundamentally, where does it come from? What's it really about? And the answer is deity. To really understand that when you're trying to rationalize the universe, where it's not a universe of motion, where you don't have that fundamental idea that everything in the universe is in motion, you know, is a motion, except the aisle. What you're really trying to do is rationalize the universe without God. It's a physics theory without God. And now more specifically, as we've begun to differentiate God and deity, you know, it's a universe without deity. Deity is fundamentally, it's that deity viewpoint that allows you to immediately understand that differential that is those two words, space and motion. Okay, and that basic differential we've mentioned when we were talking about the aisle. When you get into thinking about deity, you have this concept in that picture, as you're starting with the I am and then beginning to try to unpack it and understand it, you have a very early transitional concept called total deity, capital T, a specific designation for a transitional point in the unpacking of the I am. Getting to the point, prior to the point of having the fundamental three elements that you understand deity through, and that's the infinite one, the infinitude, and the infinity. They point out up in paper 105. And the way that works is you have total deity. You have this capital T, total deity fact, that you're conceiving of. And that is differentiated into two facts, the infinitude and the infinity. Okay. When you differentiate total deity into the infinitude and the infinity, into the essence, the beingness of total deity, and the facience, the doingness of total deity, you separate it into its beingness and its doingness, the infinitude and the infinity. That twofold pattern that you've just established there is directly why you have these two facts from a unity viewpoint. Space and motion are fundamentally tied to the infinitude and the infinity. Okay, the infinity, capital I, you know, the infinity. And motion are very intimately related in your basic philosophical understanding of reality from the top down, from the unity, from the deity point of view. Okay, and you'll see if you've gotten to the point where you know that, you can bring what they present here alive in a way that you can't with the individuality viewpoint, with just the seven absolutes of infinity. What I'll do is I'll show you, basically, you know, what handles you have to motivate what they say from the individuality viewpoint, from the seven absolutes of infinity viewpoint. But we'll also take a little journey into total deity, little t, the deity picture. And so you can see very immediately what's really behind their, what's in their mind when they're writing this, why they're saying what they're saying, more fundamentally, what's motivating this thing, the statements that they make, because some of them are kind of perplexing when you first read them. You know, I don't just mean complicated and confusing. I mean, it's like, why on earth are they saying that? You know, what is it that's so confusing to them? Okay.
When I hear motion, I automatically add something to that. To me, it's always motion of things.
Yeah.
I hear you saying something different.
Right. Challenge yourself to let go of. I mean, really, to go from only being able to comprehend the notion of a thing moving, to be able to reflect on a more abstract thought of just motion purely, you know, as a fundamental element, that to do that is to begin to make your teach your mind how to go from the individuality to the unity viewpoint. The more you can begin to be comfortable with the notion of motion being fundamental rather than things, like mass, for instance, the easier it is for you to strike step with the deity viewpoint. Because, you know, what's the fundamental thing that we sort of attribute that we talk about when you're talking about facets of deity? Deity functions. See, functions, motion. They're fundamentally linked together. Okay, and specifically, it's that that deity generator element of the infinity. That is really intimately tied to this, as you'll see, even to them, very mysterious, quite intangible in many ways, root fundamental fact of pure motion.
Paper 12, The Universe of Universes, Section 4, Space and Motion. All units of cosmic energy are in primary revolution, are engaged in the execution of their mission while swinging around the universal orbit. The universes of space and their component systems and worlds are all revolving spheres moving along the endless circuits of the master universe space levels. Absolutely nothing is stationary in all the master universe except the very center of Havona, the eternal isle of paradise, the center of gravity.
So the on-ramp nature of that first paragraph, when they start out, you might not be quite sure what they're talking about. They say, oh, wait, oh, I see what they're talking about, like a solar system, you know, planets going around the sun, and then now I've gotten this notion that there's these big circuits, you know, the super universe level and the first outer space level, and, oh, they're just saying that, you know, galaxies and solar systems and everything are all going around those big tracks, those big master universe space levels. Yes, they're saying that in the latter part of the paragraph. But take it the rest of the way. So the next step, if you have that, would be, okay, well, I know that as above, so below. So if I have a particular pattern in the macroscopic where I have sort of things like galaxies or, you know, stars and planets and whatnot, and they're all chugging around these big space circuits. I should see that in the microscopic. If I have, you know, rotating stars going around this big track, I should have something like that in the microscopic too. And that's what that initial statement is. You see, all units of cosmic energy. You can tell, I mean, that's not, you know, they're not talking about planets there. They're talking about something much more fundamental. All the way down to automatons. Right. Like I said, there are three fundamental properties of an automaton, three motions, they say. And one of those quote-unquote motions is a motion that they describe as an axial revolution. Now, to take it to the full sense, it's like, don't think of it as a little ball that you're spinning. Because see, that makes the static thing, you know, it's just a rotational motion just let that, just let that kind of nag at the back of your mind, that that's what you're challenging yourself to understand, that it's not a little thing, a little particle, static particle that you then spin like a top. That's not what they mean by that. They mean it has one of its fundamental aspects is a motion that's wrapped back on itself.
Chris, yeah? Explain to me the difference between spinning and revolutionary motion.
Okay. You have rotate, revolve, spin. I mean, you've got a number of words like that. And, the relators use it in different ways. Right. I mean, the fundamental thing is that you've got a dynamic phenomenon that you're trying to contemplate, and it's a dynamism that somehow wraps back on itself. Okay. I mean, it's one thing to imagine something that's moving, quote unquote. No matter how abstract, whatever you want to think of, a baseball moving or just some sort of abstract movingness. It's one thing to think of that movingness as just going in a straight line. It's another thing to imagine that moving phenomenon somehow wraps back on itself and catches its tail.
That's a spin.
That's something that you might start to describe as, as a rotation or a revolution a revolutionary motion. Like the Earth spinning on its axis or the Earth going around the sun. You obviously tend to use the word spin more when you're thinking like a top, rather than thinking of the Earth spinning around the sun. It's rotating on its axis, but not that part of it. You don't tend to describe the motion around the sun as a spin. So you tend to use the word spin when you're talking about something that's very, very tight, But we don't have to get into a lot of physics here. Just when they're saying revolution here, you notice they don't just use it I can't remember. Do they actually use it? As you'll see as we go forward, they're not just using that word in some localized sense. They're also using it for the going around the big circuits of the master universe. But what they're trying to point out here is an as above, so below. That just as you could expand your worldview from the revelation that the Milky Way galaxy is going around and around the center of all things, and the Milky Way galaxy is, it's rotating, little things like an automaton or whatever are also rotating, and they're also just in and of themselves going around the center of all things. Okay. And we talked about, when we were talking about the aisle, remember when they were talking about nether paradise, they were explaining to us that this whole bit of going around is generated by the aisle. That there's motion afoot, and the aisle is patterning that motion. One of the patterns it imposes upon this generalized motion, that in and of itself, you just imagine would be doing everything, just going everywhere. But the aisle is going to pattern it, it's going to constrain it. One of the constraints is that you have this north-south differential that they talked about with the aisle. And that's what is motivating those motions to be around and around the center of all things. The constant differential is, I don't want to really say powering, is constraining motion to take on that pattern of not just, any old thing, but it's making all these objects, be they automatons or galaxies, to uniformly go round and round and round and round and round and round and round. And remember I mentioned when we were talking about that, we were just going to focus on the big picture, like literally the Milky Way galaxy going around the super universe circuit. But as above, so below. The reason that there's this ongoing axial revolution, quote unquote, this motion of an automaton, why there's this pattern imposed upon it, that its motion wraps back on itself like that in some way. That's also that north-south differential of the aisle. And the east-west stability of the aisle, you can think of, I mean, it that east-west stability, if you think you want to think about this axial revolution of that ultimaton, that east-west stability establishes a plane. And then the constant north-south differential establishes a rotation. Okay. It's the same, that's exactly how we understood why the master universe had this structure. That north, that east-west stability establishes the plane of the master universe. Yeah. And the north-south differential makes things flow around the circuits. Okay.
Gravity for us pulls us down. So the gravity up there, since the Isle of Paradise is not in space or time,
mm-hmm.
then the gravity, it would be, I guess it would be pulling it up.
No. See that, and that's, you don't want to think of it pulling. You don't want to think of absolute gravity as a pulling. You'll see that'd be very, that's very important to get through this section. You're going to bring that out. I've been trying to get everyone, you know, when we're talking about absolute gravity, when we're talking about what the aisle is doing, paradise gravity, don't think of it like the earth pulling on you. Don't think of it in gravity like that. Think about it as this patterning influence, and in many ways a centering influence, imposing a center on everything. Not pulling, but just making, you know, like if you're going to say something is going to wrap back on itself, you go, well, why? What's telling it to not just go in a straight line? What's telling it wrap back on yourself? The centering influence of the aisle. That's a pattern that's imposed by the aisle. The aisle is demanding that the path be closed. Okay? It's a centering influence. Things become centered about its influence. It's a pattern of infinity. Okay.
But the motion isn't inherent, and that's why it doesn't run down.
And we're about to get to this. The whole question of motion, see, now we're going to try to, what they're about to say is motivating you to try to push all the way to the abstract like they do, and trying to really get at the core of motion itself. And I'll explain, you know, as we get into it here.
The unqualified absolute is functionally limited to space, but we're not so sure about the relation of this absolute to motion. Is motion inherent therein? We do not know. We know that motion is not inherent in space. Even the motions of space are not innate. But we are not so sure about the relation of the unqualified to motion. Who or what is really responsible for the gigantic activities of force, energy, transmutations now in progress out beyond the borders of the present seven new super universes? Concerning the origin of motion, we have the following opinions. One, we think the conjoint actor initiates motion in space. Two, if the conjoint actor produces the motions of space, we cannot prove it. Three, the universal absolute does not originate initial motion, but does equalize and control all the tensions originated by motion.
Okay, so let's start with the individuality viewpoint and give you a little bit of motivation for what they've said there. Maybe we'll start at the bottom and work back. Okay, just like that last statement. If you've read this far in the book and you're trying to wrap your mind around this thing they're calling the universal absolute, you might remember them saying that you could think of it as associated with tension or resolution of tension. And so, you know, you read this sentence like, okay, I guess I kind of see. You know, they're talking about equalize and control all the tensions. Okay, all right, so I guess maybe I understand why those thoughts are connected. And then you're trying to understand points number one and two there. You're going, well, okay, conjoint actor. Okay, they specifically used the conjoint actor label. Now, in other words, they're really kind of getting me to think about the God of action. Okay? So from a seven absolutes of infinity viewpoint, from an individuality viewpoint, if you're trying to understand, okay, motion, you know, if motion is just like the word, you know, is, I mean, this fundamentally dynamic thing, if something is going to give rise to it, wouldn't it be logical it would be the God of action that would make all this action happen? You know, all this motion? It's like, well, okay, so maybe that seems, you know, not totally ridiculous to, you know, if, you know, of the three persons that might be the source, you know, that might, you know, initiate motion, you know, why not the spear point, the God of action? Like, okay. Now, what about this stuff in the paragraph before that list, where they seem to be struggling to try to figure out what the relationship is between the unqualified absolute, which, remember, from your individuality viewpoint, the unqualified absolute is the reservoir of the potential for matter. You have all this potential for matter in a big pool, a big reservoir. And that's, and on the simple individuality viewpoint, that's what the unqualified absolute is. That's that reservoir of that potential. You can actualize that potential and make material things. Okay, and they're struggling. It's like, well, okay, I mean, if everything is a motion, so the things that I'm actualizing, you know, are fundamentally motions, not little static, you know, particles, whatever. I mean, can I just accept that? You know, that's what matter, quote unquote, is? That's what you're actualizing? But see, they know that that's not quite copacetic. Because they know what I told you at the beginning. They know that fundamentally, this phenomenon of dynamism, of motion, is a manifestation of deity. Okay? And they're going, okay, so I've got three absolutes, three reservoirs. The deity absolute, the universal absolute, and the unqualified absolute. The universal absolute and the deity absolute are deity reservoirs. They're deity absolutes, lowercase d. You know? But the unqualified absolute is a non-deity absolute. So it's like, wait a minute, that doesn't seem to make sense. How, you know, if motion is fundamentally a deity-associated phenomenon, how could the non-deity absolute be really directly responsible for it? That's what they're getting at there. That's what's between the lines there. It's like, well, is there something I can do with the individuality viewpoint to maybe quasi-motivate this? Well, if I look at things from the time viewpoint, individuality viewpoint and time viewpoint, the way you view the reservoirs is that you have the unqualified absolute and the deity absolute, the reservoir for matter and spirit, and the superadditive consequence of the relationship between the two is the universal absolute. Superadditive. That's the time viewpoint. We've talked about this. You can flip it around. You're still in the individuality viewpoint, but take the eternity viewpoint instead of the time viewpoint. Then it's different. Then you have the two deity absolutes. You have the universal absolute and the deity absolute. And the superadditive consequence of the relationship between the two is the unqualified absolute. It's the tension one in the picture. Okay? So if I take two deity absolutes and I go up to the unqualified absolute, in some way I must somehow, I'm not going away from deity. I'm actually taking deity and I'm going up with it. It must somehow subtly have a relationship to deity. See? That's, you know, that's one way you could begin to, So maybe there is, you know, some mysterious association between the unqualified absolute and motion, if you're really going up. Okay? And the other thing that you can bring in without, you know, really bringing in the deity viewpoint, just trying to play the individuality viewpoint for all that you can in understanding. You know, you have this other fact that's not one of those seven absolutes infinity. You know, you have the Paradise Trinity. Okay, that's always lurking in the background of the individuality viewpoint. And they tell you in the foreword that the Paradise Trinity is the one deity fact that directly engages infinity, that directly engages the totality of reality. And certainly, you know, in the individuality viewpoint, you know, you're kind of thinking as the unqualified absolute is this reservoir for actually making the universe of universes, you know, the reality the deity is going to identify with. And if the Paradise Trinity is the one facet of deity that engages, directly engages the totality of reality, directly engages infinity, lowercase I. If I look at it in the eternity viewpoint, which is kind of where the Paradise Trinity is anyway, you know, the Paradise Trinity, the Paradise Isle, the Eternal Isle, okay. So if I kind of go up from the universal and the deity absolutes to the unqualified absolute, and I get up to the point where I actually touch upon the Paradise Trinity, well, that's deity. Maybe that's where the motion comes in. Maybe it's the relationship between the unqualified absolute and the Paradise Trinity, that it touches it. And because it touches it, when you actualize out of that reservoir, what comes out is motion. It has the earmark of deity, the touch of deity, motion.
I was thinking that on this planet, it's somewhat mysterious for there ever to be what we would call a perpetual motion machine, that always some sort of drag enters in that wants it to come to rest.
And there was a time when what you said really was the case, but not anymore. It's just because we've thrown philosophy out of science, because it's not really true science anymore. It's just rationalizations. If you had natural philosophy, you would have for a long time now would be really nagging on you. Man, there are things that just go, that don't wind down. Like that magical perpetual motion machine that those guys are always trying to build in their garage with bike tires. Okay? You know, think. So what are you talking about, Chris? Well, think about it a little bit. I mean, even, you don't have to go to anything fancy. Most likely, a number of you have an interesting little, fairly modern thing on your refrigerator, a refrigerator magnet. You know, some little flat magnet. You know, maybe it was stuck to the phone book or whatever, you know, with a business's phone number on or something, and you slapped it on your... your dentist or whatever, and you slapped it on your refrigerator. Have you ever stopped to philosophically contemplate that refrigerator magnet? No. I mean, obviously any magnet would be the same, but just, you know, that lowly little refrigerator magnet with Bob's Repair Shop, you know, on it. Okay? Do you have to change the batteries on that thing?
No.
But it just... keep sticking and sticking and sticking and sticking. It doesn't slowly slide down the refrigerator as the batteries run, you know, and then you have to change the batteries and then it stays up again. It just goes on forever. In what sense?
Doesn't quartz have a constant?
Well, you can put an impulse on, you know, you can get quartz to oscillate, but that's just, I mean, lots of things can be oscillated. It just has a really nice...
But quartz doesn't stop, it just keeps doing it.
Yeah, it does.
It
does? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you have to actually, whack it. Keep it going, yeah. But what's something that you don't have to keep whacking? No, the Earth has got lots of friction. The Earth's rotation is changing. That's why we have to have leap seconds and stuff. You know, the moon is dragging on it and all sorts of things. There's friction there. I mean, an example is something that they didn't know about until, you know, for more modern times. If you take a certain substances and lower their temperature, and you don't have to go super, super low with some substances, they begin to manifest a property called superconductivity. Superconductors. Okay, what, you know, that's a little bit of a misleading label. Okay, what those are is perpetual motion machines. You start a current going in a superconductor and there's no resistance. It just keeps going. Like magic. Okay. It's because it's a universe of motion. It fundamentally is a universe of motion. You know, if you get things out of the way of the aisle, that north-south differential across the aisle doesn't change one iota. You don't have to change batteries on the aisle. It just keeps going and going, that constant differential. And everything is in motion because of it. That refrigerator magnet just keeps doing that thing.
Without, what is it about the lower temperature that makes that happen?
You're getting the thermal motions out of the way. You know, you're calming it down to the point. Where, you know, the thermal motion causing resistance. But okay, we don't want to get too deep into physics. But just, I mean, there are lots and lots of things, if you think about it, that speak to the fact that it's a universe of motion. You get these little windows, and it's like, wait a minute, you know, when I peer through that window, there isn't any friction, there isn't any draining, there is, you know. There's a uniform. Okay. All right, you got some?
Yeah. I'm thinking this being that wrote this paper, Perfector of Wisdom, he's going to have a top-down view from his point of view, but he's not necessarily going to see what you just described earlier, right?
No, I mean, what I'm trying to point out is what the revelators can't directly say, but are trying to get you to... and trying to motivate you to start thinking is what's between their lines. Obviously, there's something between the lines of all this stuff they're saying. You know, you're really struggling to try to figure out, you know, why are they so, you know, is motion inherent therein? I mean, they're going poetic even, you know. I mean, what is going on here?
I just figured it was a conjoint actor just sticking his finger into the...
Right, I mean, that's what every human has always thought. The magic God just does the magic thing. Okay, but there is no magic. Okay, and what they're trying to motivate us to do, if you're ready to do it, is let go of your magic God notion and to follow them. Just like Jesus said, follow me, every sentence that the revelators write is telling you the same thing. Follow me. Do you have the courage to follow me? Says the Perfector of Wisdom. Follow what I'm suggesting here. It'll lead you to a reformation of your whole worldview.
Okay, Chris.
Okay?
That's wonderful. But now, see, this the unqualified absolute is functionally limited to space.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even understand that.
Okay, so you have space. We talked about that back in the previous paper. Space is basically this region that we call the master universe, and there isn't space beyond that. And this presence of the unqualified is just in that space.
So he's functionally limited to space. He can't move out of...
No, it's just what it's doing is just within that domain. It's not outside of that domain.
So, but in order for him to do anything, he's limited to space.
Yeah. Only, of course, it's not a he. And a matter of fact, the unqualified absolute doesn't even function. So that sentence in and of itself is illogical. I mean, we've talked about this before. I mean, if they give you the name of one of the reservoirs, like the unqualified absolute, and then they say function, what does that mean? It means it's not really to be understood from the individuality viewpoint. You got to turn it around to the unity viewpoint where you have deity facets that function. Reservoirs don't function. They just sit there. Bleh. Okay, like a lake. Okay, but what when you flip the unqualified absolute around to the unity viewpoint, the deity viewpoint, what facet of deity is that? the unqualified absolute, the infinite capacity, okay? That's the actual functioning thing, if they ever say functioning like they did right there. That's, you know, they did the same thing back in the Paradise Paper, you know? They were trying to get you to not just try to understand everything from the individuality viewpoint. It's like, you know, it's really the infinite capacity that's functioning, okay, in relationship to the aisle. Okay, but beyond, I mean, that's one thing. But the real meat is the rest of the unity viewpoint. Let's take the unity viewpoint. What did I say right up front? I mean, you differentiate total deity, capital T, into the infinitude and the infinity, and that twofold pattern is space and motion, essence and facience, beingness and doingness. The infinitude and the infinity. It's the infinity, okay, that is very intimately tied. That element of deity is intimately tied to motion. So in the deity viewpoint, in the unity viewpoint, what facets of deity are really directly, immediately related to the infinity? Well, the infinity, when we have the three elements, the infinite one, the infinitude, and the infinity, we number those 1, 2, 3. So, you know, element number 3, the infinity. Which things are really intimately tied to element number 3, the infinity? Well, the facet of deity called the spirit, as in the deity of God, the spirit, the conjoint actor, okay, that facet of deity, the spirit, is a direct expression of the infinity. It's element 3 directly expressed. A direct expression of the infinity, a direct expression of that which is intimately tied to this pattern of motion relative to space. Okay? So, is it not very logical to think of that facet of deity as being intimately involved? You know, we think the spirit, here, just reword this, we think the spirit initiates motion in space. Yeah, it's a direct expression of the deity that sort of gives rise to motion, you know, the doingness that is motion. Okay? Yeah. That's really why you can say number one there. We think the spirit initiates motion in space. Okay? And, you know, same way you could, you know, you go to number two, well, it's like, well, okay, maybe, you know, maybe the spirit is tied to the motions of space as well. But another thing that you begin to discover as you begin to study deity is the spirit and the Paradise Trinity often have a reciprocal relationship in things. If one does something, the other does something in sync with that action. Or that functioning, if we're going to think in the deity viewpoint. Remember when we were talking about Nether Paradise, and we were recognizing that second zone around the center of Nether Paradise, that was tied to the origination of space as a co-absolute fact. But what was actually centered at the center of Nether Paradise? Yeah, the Paradise Trinity. The co-infinite one, okay? Very likely, I mean, you know, you might want to think of, like they're doing here, the spirit as being the initiator, but the Paradise Trinity is probably what directly is giving rise to the motions of space. Because that's the immediate thing it engages as you move out another paradise.
Talking about the motions of space being the space respiration.
Yes, the motions of space, not the motions that are in space.
I never caught that before. I thought they were talking about the same thing.
No. That's why they're italicizing in and of, okay? Over and over, okay? Motions of space. A very mysterious, a very transcendent fact. Okay? That's a high, that, you know, see that, you know, we cannot prove it. I mean, there's a lot of question mark there, but I can tell you that my intuition says that's a pretty likely possibility if you sorted out the details, that you've got this, the spirit directly doing the in space, and in response to that, the Paradise Trinity doing the of space. The two are really, you know, two sides of the same picture.
Yep. My mind says motion has to be. Take the opposite of that. If the universe had no motion, there couldn't even be an awareness that there was anything.
Right.
Motion has to be.
Right. If you didn't have motion, you'd have the concept of the I am. You know, and there's, and that concept of the I am, there is a direct expression of that motionlessness that is in that concept of the I am. When you unpack the I am, there's one little measure of that motionlessness that still stands. It's represented by the word paradise. It's fundamentally the motionless that you're conceiving of conceptually. You know, it's a fundamental aspect of what is the Paradise Isle and what is the Paradise Trinity. Those are facts that are in the first functional level of total deity, the stasis of deity, the motionlessness. Okay, that's what that word paradise is about. It's just that it's only that. Everything else is motion. For the reason that you just intuitively are recognizing, it has to be emotion, or how could there be, how could there be any consciousness? I mean, again, see, what do I always point out? What's the word that they use for the fullness of consciousness when you're liberated from the limitations here and you actually have a Marantia mind that's more set free to move? That consciousness is called moda. That's the word motion in Latin.
It says somewhere in the book, and I forget, in relationship to time and space and motion, the difference between the Spirit and the Creator Son, the Creator Son is...
Oh, I see what you're getting. Yeah. The Creator Son and the Creative Mother Spirit, you're thinking.
Yeah.
Those two, yeah. Yeah, that dual nature where one is constrained by space but not time, and the other, the reciprocal. Right? I mean, the Creator Son is constrained by space but not time. And the Creative Mother Spirit is constrained by time but not space. Yeah. But that's, you know, that's at a much lower level than we're trying to think right now. We're way, what we're trying to contemplate here is all the way up at the top of everything. It immediately starts touching upon people thinking about what really is the first thought of unpacking the I am, like I'm trying to point out. That's how high we're thinking here. Because that's where motion, the raw fact of motion lies. It lies in the core nature of what's going on here. I mean, it's such a transcendent thing that to talk about it, I had to coin a word. We don't even have a proper word in the English language. You have to coin the word patience to really start precisely talking about this. That, it's that transcendent. That's what they're talking about here.
Why then doesn't this perfecter of wisdom, he should be able to come to the same conclusions you did?
No, that's what I'm trying to point. He knows these things that I'm saying. I'm just trying to show you.
I hear him mentioning the Trinity, though. Paradise Trinity.
Right, but remember, you know how there's a whole bunch
because it's related to experiential.
Right, you have to acquire all that part of the revelation so experientially.
He's acquiring it the same as we are at the same rate.
Right, he did, but he knows what I'm talking about. I'm trying to show you that because he knows that's why he's written it the way he's written it. He's trying to get you to follow his lead, you know, and not be satisfied with the rationalizations of the individuality viewpoint.
Yeah.
Take it to the next level.
So he's hoping we'll see, like you did, the Paradise Trinity kind of reading between the lines.
Yeah, and you'll see it more as you go forward.
The way he phrases it, he kind of allows enough space for us to kind of contemplate that.
But if you're not ready for that, it's easy to just kind of, you know,
take it very
simplistically. And like I said, even that first paragraph, you don't have to go, good grief, units of cosmic energy. You can sort of just immediately forget that. Oh, yeah, okay, just, you know, like the earth going around the sun and the things going around. Okay, you know, you can take it very simply because you can start with a simple point of view. But, you know, it goes way beyond that. This is the kind of section that goes way deep. One other little thing about the total deity viewpoint. Okay, and this whole bit about element three. Okay, so the spirit is a direct expression of the infinity, of element three. The infinite upholder is the relationship of element three to itself, the relationship of the infinity to itself. Okay, item number three here in the list, the universal absolute, you know, dot, dot, dot. You know, this whole bit about does not originate in initial motion, but does equalize and control all the tensions originated by motion. Okay, if you take the universal absolute, turn it around to the unity viewpoint, that facet of deity is the infinite upholder. The relationship of the infinity to itself, the relationship of element three to itself, that's what they're describing here. You know, if that element three is fundamentally tied to this notion of motion, if I have motion and I want to imagine some sort of equalization and control, some sort of a feedback loop on this motion. You know, the motion, you know, fed back on itself. Well, that's exactly what the infinite upholder is, see. It's that relationship of element three to itself. I mean, you know, you have a motion, you go, okay, well, I see what it is. Well, I need to modify that, or, you know, or I have this motion and that motion, and I need to get those two to work together. I'm relating motion back to itself. I'm playing motion off itself to create an equilibrium amongst this, all these expressions of it. And you just think about that. That's literally what is embodied in the notion of the infinite upholder, the relationship of the infinity of element three back to itself. Yeah. Okay, so from the unity viewpoint, see, items 1, 2, and 3 have a much more philosophical immediacy, much less of, well, you know, the magic guy, he waves his magic wand and he initiates motion in space. You know, it's much more just directly an expression of what they are, not what they're doing. It's what they are. The spirit is element three directly expressed. It's just what the spirit is, the initiator of motion in space. Okay, it's the functioning of that facet of deity. And then, yeah, see, and it's just, I'm just tweaking this a little bit. I'm also, you know, let's, you know, never let yourself forget about the Trinity. See, always kind of be, you know, as soon as you start talking about this stuff, what we understood about Nether Paradise should really make you want to be, where does the Trinity fit in here? Well, I know that was the picture that they gave me in the Nether Paradise section. That when I'm talking about physics stuff like this, at the center of all the physics was the Paradise Trinity, the center of Nether Paradise. So that has to always be there. And so you want to look for it kind of between the lines. Okay, now look at this next little thing he says here.
In outer space, the force organizers are apparently responsible for the production of the gigantic universe wheels, which are now in process of stellar evolution. But their ability so to function must have been made possible by some modification of the space presence of the unqualified absolute.
This was that little single sentence in the book that we've already read, that curious little thing that I pointed out back in the previous paper. We were reading about Nether Paradise, and we were going on, and we noticed that they said this very curious thing. You know, all the time, almost all the time, they talk about pervaded and unpervaded space. You know, so you've got, you know, the space we're in, it's pervaded space, and the reservoirs above and below are unpervaded space. Those are the terms they use, pervaded and unpervaded. You know, in other words, is it, you know, empty space, or is it space filled with the force charge, with primordial force, pervaded by that? But remember, I pointed out that there's a even deeper thing, that there were, you know, there's space potency too is an issue. And there was this one sentence referring to that where they said the contrast wasn't between pervaded and unpervaded, it was between pervadable and unpervadable. Okay, so no force charge in the picture at all. We just have the presence of the unqualified absolute. But in two different states, the space potency is in two different states. In one state, it's pervadable. You could put force charge, you know, add force charge to the picture. And the other, it's unpervadable. You can't add force charge to the picture. And so what they're referring to, when you talk about going out to the outer space levels and imagine someone like getting the Andromeda galaxy going. Okay, you know that you have the primary force organizer gets the whirl and the force charge going, and then the associate force organizers get in there and start condensing that whirl into ultimatons, bottling that motion up into little packages. Okay, and you also know that the primary force organizers have an even little higher role to play. They're the ones that, as unpervaded space passes through their presence near paradise, it becomes pervaded space. So they have, you know, the force organizers have to do with those basic things about the force charge. Hence the name force organizer, see? You know, even at that fundamental level of making it pervaded in the first place. But what about the pervadable part? Who's responsible for making space potency pervadable? Okay, that's what they're saying here. See, but their ability so to function, you know, the force organizers, must have been made possible by some modification of the space presence of the unqualified absolute. Yeah, who took that space potency and changed its state and made it pervadable so that these guys could do something, you know, upon that foundation? See, again, and it's like, well, if I'm going to go beyond them, I mean, who do I have that's higher, that's at the center of all this physics stuff? Who's beyond the force organizers? The Trinity, see, the Paradise Trinity. See, the Paradise Trinity is always behind the scenes here. And like I said, I mean, they're constantly... The revelatory mandate is they can't directly reveal this whole process of experience, you know, the true or origination of experiential deity as coming from the other side of the universal one of infinity, the Paradise Trinity side. This whole Paradise Trinity functioning source thing giving rise to the Mother, that's not directly revealed like the Father is, because then your acquirement of it wouldn't be true. To really appreciate experiential deity and its source, you need to experientially acquire a relationship to it. It can't be just, you know, some existential thing that you think about, because that's not the truth of it. It's not existential deity. It's experiential deity. And the source of that is the Trinity. And so the Trinity is always being hinted at.
That is so subtle.
And I can take this further, but it'll get really advanced.
Yeah,
but you know, I mean, one of the things, I mean, when you notice the unqualified absolute, and like we saw, they said the unqualified absolute is functionally limited. You know, they were obviously referring to the infinite capacity there. Okay. Really the deity viewpoint, that facet of deity functioning. Well, the infinite capacity is just at the infinite level. But there are downstepped expressions of the infinite capacity of that deity. And that can, you know, that would function at sub-infinite levels. Co-infinite, absolute, co-absolute, etc. You know, like the architects of the master universe are absentite capacity type deity. You know, they're that type of deity. So, you know, they're a downstepped expressioning of this kind of functioning. They're going to have some intimate relationship with the unqualified. The Paradise Trinity has that kind of intimate relationship. Once you fully unpack the Paradise Trinity, like we will when we go through the appendix of total deity, you'll see very directly. What I was alluding to when you try to take that, you know, try to use your individuality viewpoint to motivate it, and you think of the unqualified absolute as being this super additive consequence, you know, getting up to the highest levels where maybe the one thing that engages the totality of reality, the Paradise Trinity, might be directly interfacing with it, you know, you can actually unpack that understanding of why those are so intimately coupled. Okay.
What is existential existence bringing something existential?
Well, the reservoirs are there existentially, and then you, to be a little bit more precise, Havona is an eternal creation. Or to think about it temporally, quote unquote, it was made before time began. But it was made. There's material energy there that was actualized out of the reservoir of the potential for material energy, out of the unqualified absolute. You actualize some of that potential as the central universe.
I almost get the impression that existential creation is almost something prior to...
Yeah, it is. And that's what I was about to explain. See, that's what I'm saying. Technically, you want to think of of the central universe as an eternal domain. It's an experiential domain. See, it's not actually literally an existential domain. It's an experiential domain. Havona natives experience. You're going to have experiences when you're going through Havona. The aisle, the thing that's antecedent, that existential being antecedent, like you're thinking, that's the aisle. Sequence is not experiential on the aisle. It's existential. Mind is absolute.
Are the billion spheres constructed spheres, just like
not like that. No, they're not constructed temporally like the architectural spheres.
They're not material
either. Yeah, they are. Yeah, they're matter. They're
not material like the world.
But they were made by the universal creator and the co-creator, the first and second sources and centers made them, is the way you'd want to think about it. I mean, not only made them, but, you know, in that, when you're thinking about it like that, they made the third source and center, and at the same time, they made the central universe. Yeah, if you think about it, it's a temporal thing. I mean, obviously, internally, it didn't work like that, but that's the way you understand it logically.
When they made directly the third source and center, the Trinity,
I didn't want to go into that.
But Trinity responded. What? Like you said earlier.
Right. I'll give you a little teaser to support your good insight there. That's a very good insight on your part. Who's the parent of the Havona natives? Do you remember?
The Trinity.
Yeah, wow. Not the Father, Son, or Spirit. Those are Trinity origin beings. Wow. Yeah, especially Havona is very much. The Paradise Trinity's place. Yeah. So that's kind of the end of the really intense abstract part there. That's really challenging you, if you're ready, to try to bring in the deity viewpoint and all these higher perspectives, really understanding that motion fundamentally is this. It is not an individuality viewpoint fact. It's a deity fact. It's that fundamental doingness, you know, that is there through deity. Deity functions. Okay? And so if you're really going to understand space and motion, you need to bring in the deity viewpoint. Let's flip it back around again, which is what they're about to do now, and make it a little bit simpler again, a little bit more individuality viewpoint, and try to understand what's going on.
Space is, from the human viewpoint, nothing, negative. It exists only as related to something positive and non-spatial. Space is, however, real. It contains and conditions motion. It even moves. Space motions may be roughly classified as follows. 1. Primary motion, space respiration, the motion of space itself. 2. Secondary motion, the alternate directional swings of the successive space levels. 3. Relative motions, relative in the sense that they are not evaluated with paradise as a base point. Primary and secondary motions are absolute motion in relation to unmoving paradise. 4. Compensatory or correlating movement designed to coordinate all other motions.
Okay, let's just make sure we the basic of what they're bringing out. So those first two, you know, it's basically what we were talking about when we were talking about Nether Paradise, and that there was one expression that was in every direction, that, for instance, was related to the respiration thing, and remembering that it's not a motion. You know, the respiration of space is not a motion away from the center of the master universe, you know, like this. It isn't vectorially moving in and out, you know, like it's, you know, blowing apart in a, like a, you know, bomb going off and then collapsing like it's falling into a black hole or something, okay? It's not that kind of vectorial motion. Every point in space is going in and out in 2 billion-year cycles. Every single point simultaneously. It's not a vectorial motion. It's a scalar outward and then inward motion. Okay, that's the space respiration.
So it's like dots in a balloon.
You say it's kind of like an elastic?
Yep. That's the way scientists, you know, tend to try to explain, or like to give you something to picture as galaxies, they'll give you the raisin cake model. And I often mention that, you know, I mean, imagine putting a raisin cake in the oven and then, you know, as it rises, as it bakes, you know, all the raisins are moving away from each other. It's not because there's one special raisin. You know, you can stand on any raisin and all the other raisins are moving away from you. The whole thing is expanding. It's not blowing apart from some motionless center point in the center of the cake. Okay? It's like the stretching of an elastic, yeah. Okay, so both that space respiration and the force charge and everything that's synchronized with it, okay, is this absolute kind of motion. It's relative to the aisle, and the aisle imposes its influence equally at every point, so it's this outward and inward from every point. And then the other one is the alternate directional swings. That's like we were just talking about. You know, that what makes this motion in the, you know, these unidirectional motions in these circuits, either clockwise or counterclockwise, it's that constant differential, north-south differential of the aisle. See, that motion is relative to the aisle, you know, or if you want to say it that way, or the way they say it, with paradise as a base point, so they don't have to be you know, saying that the absolute motion is relative to the aisle, which is kind of a silly thing to say. But you see what I mean. It's center, you know, what it is based upon is the aisle, not some secondary thing. You know, the Earth goes around the sun, not around the aisle. That's not an absolute motion. And then you have relative motion, so just every other thing you can, you know, think of. Everything else. And then compensatory and correlating movement. Okay, and they're saying, you know, can relate the relatives and the absolutes. We talked about one of those when we were talking about the aisle. The aisle doesn't do it directly, but when you're talking about the big picture, Remember, it's all going through the dark gravity bodies. The influence of the aisle is going through that conduit of the dark gravity bodies, bringing it down a little bit, allowing it to have some quasi-relativity to it. And they mentioned there wasn't just the constant north-south differential, but there was occasionally out here over time, not at the aisle, there's no time on the aisle, but out here, in other words, on the other side of the dark gravity bodies, every once in a while, they noticed that there was a east-west influence that was being imposed. In other words, keeping the plane in the plane, things start to get lopsided away from the plane. There was an adjustments that were made through the dark gravity bodies to keep it. Okay, that's a compensatory motion, see? That is, that does have an absolute component, but it's in response to all the relative motions that have gotten everything kind of out of balance, and so something is above them, above those relative motions, an absolute motion is imposing a stabilizing influence, on the picture. Okay, so that's an example of a compensatory motion. Okay, so that's the basic picture. They're just saying, recognizing that everything's in motion, and the great majority of it is relative motions, like we can easily understand. But there are a few of these things that are directly expressions of things that are based upon the aisle, like the north-south differential of the aisle is what's behind that motion, not the Great Wall of Galaxies or something. Being behind the motion. Okay, so that's that basic picture. They're just trying to get you to have a much bigger picture of motion. Okay, and then they're going to talk about that picture a little bit.
The present relationship of your sun and its associated planets, while disclosing many relative and absolute motions in space, tends to convey the impression to astronomic observers that you are comparatively stationary in space and that the surrounding starry clusters and streams are engaged in outward flight at ever-increasing velocities as your calculations proceed outward in space. But such is not the case. You fail to recognize the present outward and uniform expansion of the physical creations of all pervaded space. Your own local creation, Nebadon, participates in this movement of universal outward expansion. The entire seven superuniverses participate in the 2 billion-year cycles of space respiration, along with the outer regions of the master universe.
Okay. Now, in the current cosmological, so-called cosmological picture, I mean, that's not the case. We now have what I'm talking about that's analogized with a raisin cake. We now, when we think of the Big Bang, as the current rationalization scheme for this outward motion, we don't think of that as there was a big blob of stuff and then someone lit the fuse and, it went flying in every direction, vectorially, radially, outward from the explosion point. But they used to think that. I mean, in the late 50s, if you took a course in cosmology, say from George Gamow here at CU, he would have told the story of the beginning. The term he used for the blob of stuff that was just sitting there before someone lit the fuse, he called that the yelm. And in the beginning was the yelm, and then someone lit the fuse, and kerpow, okay, everything went flying off. Okay. Initially, like they're saying there, that's what we thought, long after the revelation was even in print. Scientists were basically still thinking this. Okay, they don't anymore. They have this more scalar viewpoint where, they think of there is no special point and everything is expanding. Okay, and that's what they're trying to get you to recognize. It's like, well, that's pretty easy for us to recognize because we've kind of all changed our viewpoint now. We don't think of the yelm picture anymore. Okay, but, it's not the Big Bang. It's something much more amazing and complex than that. But it is this. What was that?
Does that mean the Earth is expanding?
Everything. Yeah, everything experiences this inward and outward motion. And they're going to mention that here just in the next
paragraph.
The
globe of the Earth itself, because it has.
Yeah. Right. But I mean, everything is. I mean, you are. Everything is.
The space between our own.
Everything. Selves. Yeah. Everything participates in this universal inward and outward motion. Okay. Everything. Okay. Nothing is excluded. Every atom, every ultimaton is awash in this universal expansion contraction that's imposed on everything.
So the Earth would get larger then. Time,
but you can't tell because there's nothing. Everything is participating in. They point out, there's no way to use this as some sort of a metric, either for time or.
Your ruler
expands. Everything expands. Okay. Okay. All right. So you have that basic picture. Okay, they were trying to correct the very simplistic thinking we had back in the first half of the 20th century. But as we'll see, we need to temper it going forward. Is there anything else I wanted to mention in there? Notice the one little hint of, they're about to talk about it here in a little bit, of the Hubble flow, quote-unquote, picture, that of observing galaxies out in the outer space levels, and they're all redshifted, and it all looks like everything's moving away, and it has a very simple pattern to it, that if something is twice as far away, it looks like it's going away from you at twice the speed. So that if you plot velocity on the y-axis and distance on the x-axis, and put a dot for every galaxy that you measure. You measure its recession velocity using the redshifting of the spectral lines. It allows you to deduce a Doppler velocity. So that gives you a y-coordinate. And then you use some other method to try to make your best guess at how far away this thing is to give you the x-coordinate. So you can put a dot on this xy plot. And you find that all the dots basically are on a line. And so there's a line with a slope. And the slope of that line is the Hubble constant, which we're going to bring up in a second. So that basic picture of that we appear to be stationary and that everything is moving away from us at ever increasing velocities, as it gets farther and farther away. All right. So now look at the little there's a tiny little paragraph that they throw in here as an additional little teaser.
When the universe is expand and contract, material masses in pervaded space alternately move against and with the pull of paradise gravity. The work that is done in moving the material energy mass of creation is space work, but not power energy work.
So now that's a. I mean, if you haven't had a basic physics course, you really don't have any on ramp to that paragraph. So let me just give you a little bit of a picture there, what they're pointing to. Okay, the first thing they're saying that, if you, all the masses, like we were just saying, every mass, you, stars, tables, rulers, everything, is involved in this universal expansion contraction. But you don't want to think of it. When they say alternately moving against and with the pull of paradise gravity, like, well, that sounds kind of like the Yelm picture, doesn't it? And aren't they saying that I've got the Isle of Paradise at the center and pulling against the gravity, and then if I'm being pulled in by gravity, I'm pulling against it. Okay, isn't that what that means? No, it's not power energy work. Okay, if you take a picture like that, like instead of the Isle of Paradise, let's think of the sun. You got the sun sitting there. And I'm in a rocket ship. If I'm going to try to get away from the sun, I actually have to expend energy. Sun doesn't want to let me go. It's pulling on me. it's exerting an inward force on me. Power energy work, I mean, when you define work in a basic physics class, work is equal to the force that's being applied times the distance over which that force is applied. That's the work done. Okay. See, so if I'm in a spaceship and I'm trying to get away from the sun, you know, I have to do a certain amount of work because there's a force being applied as I'm gunning the engines and I'm over a certain distance, I'm, you know, working against this force. See, they're working against. Literally, you've made an analytic expression of that thought. You've defined the word work as an algebra equation. It's equal to the amount of force that's pulling on you times the distance over which you worked against it. Okay? It's not like that. This expansion constraint is not like that. That's what they're just saying. It is not that kind of power energy work. Force times distance work. Because this motion is not vectorial motion against a Newtonian gravity object at the center of the master universe. The Isle of Paradise is not literally at the center of that, space-time thing as a linear gravity drawing force. This is not vectorial motion. What is it? Okay, think of it a little bit more fundamentally about gravity. Instead of thinking of it in that kind of Newtonian two-body force picture, okay, just a single object is a mass, like the sun. It's fundamentally an inward motion, is what that gravitating fact is. I mean, it isn't like if I have one object that isn't gravitating, it's only when I put another object in the picture, then it turns on its gravity force, pulls it in. It's tractor beam. That's not the way it works. It's just always gravitating, whatever the heck that is. See? It's always doing that. It's always in motion. It's a motion. It's an inward motion. So if I put two inward motions, next to each other, they move towards each other. They are. Okay. So if fundamentally a mass, the material masses in pervaded space. If I have a mass, it's an inward motion. And imposed upon that universally is sometimes there's an outward motion, sometimes there's an inward motion. Sometimes, that motion is the opposite of what this fundamentally is an inward motion. Sometimes it's with it. That's what that's about. Sometimes this universal phenomenon is going with the mass direction, and sometimes it's going against it. Or vice versa. The object is going with or against that universal motion. That's what they're talking about. Okay. And you don't need to, every single object is like that. It's an inward motion, and this is an inward-outward thing.
Okay. Is that in relation to space respiration?
Yeah, right. That's what the inward-outward. So, and the reason that they say that phenomenon is not power energy work, but it's space work is the term they coined. Okay, they pointed this out back when they're talking about the respiration. Fundamentally, it's space that respirates. It's what's really behind the whole picture. The stuff that's in space is just synced to it. So space goes out and you got to go out too. See, space is doing the work. Space is what's, whatever is behind the motions of space, it's what's driving the whole phenomenon. That's why all the galaxies go in and out, because they're locked to it. So it's doing the work, whoever is moving it. See? Yeah, so who or what is really responsible? See, that's what they were getting at. Okay?
And even a deeper question, why?
And why? And
why
right.
Why do we have space?
Right. Why do we have respiration? Right? I mean, I've quite pointed out, it's a beautiful picture for an immediate on-ramp relationship to the universe. It's like, wow, I believe as a Christian that our God is a living God. And living beings breathe. And I'll be danged if the universe isn't very simply described as a respirating phenomenon. Not an expanding, contracting phenomenon, but there's an equilibrium size, like a lung has an equilibrium size. And it, you know, it doesn't go like this. That's not what a lung does. A lung has an equilibrium size, and it does. That's what the universe does. The master universe has an equilibrium size, and it respirates.
Yep.
Can they give us a time frame on expansion to contraction?
It's a 2 billion-year cycle, roughly a 2 billion-year cycle.
Talk about the respiration.
What's the rotational cycle?
We don't know. We don't know how long things take to go around.
We are.
Yeah, but we don't know how long it takes to go around the big circuit of the super universe, for instance. Yeah, you don't know. Okay, so that's what they mean by space work. See, it's really, space is mysteriously doing this thing and everything else is sort of locked to it and saying, yes, massa.
There is a place where it talks about all the different motions that the Earth is going through at one time, not only rotating about its axis, but the wobble and around the sun, and then the sun around another center.
Right, we'll get to that here.
And there are how many motions altogether, at least?
Well, there's lots of, and that's, we don't want to go through all of that, but keep that thing that she's alluding to in mind, that it's very complicated. I mean, you have the Earth, you know, the Earth's rotating, the Earth's going around the sun. The sun, you know, has a residual motion around the center of the little Andromeda Nebula. The Andromeda Nebula is part of the bigger thing of Nebadon, and there's a center of mass of that. And so, you know, there's a motion about the center of mass of Nebadon, and Nebadon has some motion about the center of mass of the minor sector. And the minor sector is going around the center of the Milky Way. And, you know, okay, so there's all these different motions. Okay. You know, not to mention the fact that minor sectors also have some motion about the center of mass of the major sector. So, you know, it's very complex.
The whole thing is going around.
So, and science doesn't know about any of that stuff, okay? So obviously when they're doing redshift stuff, there's going to be lots of errors because they're not, you know, they're subtracting out the rotation of the Earth and the motion of the Earth around the sun. So that isn't, but they don't know that they need to subtract all this other stuff out. So, you know, that obviously is distorting a lot of the, you know, if I'm actually, like moving around Andromeda, if I'm kind of going in this direction, well, if I'm moving towards John, that's going to be blue shifting, see, you know, the light coming from John and, you know, all that. So there's blue shifts and red shifts all gobbled together and all distorting the picture. And they'll allude to that here coming up. But, because that's the very next thing. They're going to talk about those spectroscopic, you know, using a spectroscope to look at the spectral lines coming from a star and seeing that they're not in the place they should be. They're Doppler shifted.
Although your spectroscopic estimations of astronomic velocities are fairly reliable when applied to the starry realms belonging to your super universe and its associate super universes. Such reckonings with reference to the realms of outer space are wholly unreliable.
Wow, holy.
Spectral lines are displaced from the normal towards the violet by an approaching star. Likewise, these lines are displaced towards the red by a receding star. Many influences interpose to make it appear that the recessional velocity of the external universes increase at the rate of more than 100 miles a second for every million light years increase in distance. By this method of reckoning, subsequent to the perfection of more powerful telescopes, it will appear that these far distant systems are in flight from this part of the universe at the unbelievable rate of more than 30,000 miles a second. But this apparent speed of recession is not real. It results from numerous factors of error, embracing angles of observation and other time-space distortions.
Okay, so this is a very big paragraph in the book in terms of physics, some basic physics. Okay, so you have the, you know, this, the, just like you know about the train whistle, you know, the approaching train and the receding train, the change in the pitch, okay? Yeah, the light from the stars and the galaxies do the same thing. Now, that's just that basic thing they're talking about, redshifting and blue shifting, okay?
So when you're pushing on the waves going forward, in front is the blue shift.
Well, no, if you're, you know, you're coming at them, so they're, yeah. Okay. Yeah, pushing on the waves, you're just, you know, going into them. This is the one sort of way we can try to figure out what's going on out there in the outer space levels. We can see the photons coming from these galaxies, and we can look to see what kind of photons are we getting. And we know, you know, this is one of the first things we noticed. Whoa, all the spectral lines are in the wrong places. They're all redshifted. It appears that all the galaxies are moving away from us. And they are. You know, we know we're in the expansion part. But there's all these issues, like we were alluding to, when you talk about all these errors, you know, things like not subtracting out all the internal motions in the Milky Way galaxy and stuff that we don't know about and all those sorts of things. But all the details aside, you know, back in the late 20s, going forward for, about two and a half decades, as scientists, as astronomers were trying to do that basic thing that Hubble did back there in the late 20s of trying to make that graph that I was talking about, looking at the apparent recession velocity, putting that on the y-axis, trying to figure out a distance and putting it on the x-axis and making dots for each galaxy, and they all seem to basically fall on a line. And the slope of that line is the Hubble constant. That's the slope. Notice that they gave you this thing 100 miles a second. Okay, that's a velocity. For every million light years. It's a distance. A velocity over a distance. See, that's the y over the x. That's the slope of the line. Okay, the slope of that line, the Hubble constant, is that. And that initial...
And this predicted it.
Well, no. I mean... We already knew this as they were writing this.
But we didn't know it.
Yeah, we knew it. The late 20s is when, you know, and even a little bit before that is when, And this number here is that initial number that we got for the slope of the line. Okay. Now, a current number, you know, they've been ruminating on this issue and all of, you know, they can tell there's all kinds of vicissitudes with it. And they've been, you know, going around and around on this for, especially in real earnest since the 70s. And basically now they think that the number they think is more appropriate is a factor of 10 smaller than this. Okay? And just give you an idea, even with our appreciation of how complicated this is to really pin down, we've changed our number by a factor of 10. Okay? But that's not the point. If you, they're saying, okay, if you take the way you saw things back then, which gave you that Hubble constant of 100 instead of 10, see, by this method of reckoning, if you just assume that slope of 100, they say, okay, when you get more powerful telescopes, you'll notice galaxies moving, you know, at this unbelievable rate of more than 30,000 miles a second. Okay. There's a whole bunch of question marks there.
Redshifting.
Redshifted, at that effective recessional velocity. Right? Okay, now from a purely modern astronomer perspective, you see the 30, you know, and even if you said, but they're using the old, let's translate it to the newer Hubble constant, let's use 10, and then it would be 3,000 instead of 30,000. But even then, I mean, even if you forget about that, I mean, if you just take 30,000, you're going, that's nothing unbelievable. I see galaxies that have apparent recessional velocities gazillion times higher than that through my telescopes. So, I mean, whoever wrote this paragraph is, you know, is clueless. You know, they were trying to be fancy and imaginative and giving you an unbelievable velocity. Well, it's not unbelievable to me, you know, cynical scientist. I see recessional velocities vastly greater than that. So, yeah, this book is garbage. It doesn't have anything to offer me. You know, it's some religionist trying, you know, taking the numbers of the late 20s and playing with them and trying to make them fancy God numbers. Okay, that's what they're going to think. No, let's think about it. What does it say? It's like they know the limit. You know, they know how poor a number that is. But by this method of reckoning, let's just go with it. I can work with that, they're saying. Let's use your, just use your number, and let me give you a velocity. Yeah, okay, so what? No. I've given you a slope, and I've given you a y-coordinate. I mean, I think everyone in this room at some point took enough algebra or something, you know, where you made an xy plot and you did things like, if I've got a line in that plot, if I have a y coordinate, I can go over to the line and then I can go down and see what x coordinate is attached to that y coordinate, you know, if it's on that line, you know, so just do that. You've got a slope and you've got a y coordinate. Okay, so calculate the x coordinate. Okay, well, how do I do that? I have a velocity, and I have a velocity divided by a distance. Well, if I take the velocity, 30,000, and I divide it by that ratio of velocity over distance, I'll end up with a distance. The velocities will cancel, and the distance will end up in the numerator. So it's 30,000 divided by 100, which is 300. Okay, so what the pair of sentences actually say is, when you have more powerful telescopes, you'll notice that there's a distance that's curious, that's special, that stands out. A distance of 300 million light years. You'll notice, you know, and let me start to fill it out. What you'll notice is, by and large, all the galaxies you see in these more powerful telescopes are within 300 million light years of you. As you start looking out in the outer space levels, there's more and more and more galaxies, and kind of builds up to a crescendo at 300 million light years, and then it kind of starts to peter out. That's exactly what we see. What we see is, the more powerful telescopes, those finally came around in the 1990s. When you get to the 1990s, and they started really looking carefully, they noticed something curious, that just what I said, that basically, you know, you've got, increasing density, and it starts to really increase, and it gets to a crescendo, and so there's basically just this massive wall of galaxies all the way around us, you know, millions and millions of galaxies all the way around us at a distance, you know, where the outer margin is basically 300 million light years. Okay, what is that? Well, you're looking at the second outer space level. Okay, remember how this works. You've got 50 million light years of the first outer space level, where the density goes up and then back down again. You know, up for 25 million and down for 25 million. Okay, and then you got a 50 million light year gap. And then you start in the second outer space level and it starts going up again. You know, and let's say, well, let's see, if, I don't know if this is 50-50, maybe this is 500. You know, so the center would be about 250 out. You know, so it'd go up for 250 and then down for 250 out to the outer edge of the second outer space level. So in other words, if you kind of built the second outer space level out to the, you know, close to the center, you know, you'd have, there's 250 there, and then 50 and 50, another 100. You know, the center would be about 350 million light years out. Okay. What we actually see is it's not quite, you know, it starts to really fall off at about 300. Okay. And what you see, and it's very interesting to see how they've tried to rationalize this observation. Like I said, that first appeared in the 90s. They rationalize it with their godless so-called cosmology. If you have a godless cosmology, you don't have a first source and center. You don't have a special point. You know, in the current it's called the cosmological principle. This assumption that's made is that because there's no God, there couldn't be any special point in the universe. The universe has to be completely homogeneously uniform. You know, it's infinite, and you can just go to any point, and you look in every direction, and it's just the same. Doesn't matter where you are. You know, there's not going to be some big center of symmetry with things going in levels around that or anything like that. Okay, that can't exist because there's no God. I mean, that's so. The fundamental assumption is this cosmological principle, this notion that it has to be completely uniform. Well, you know, they started looking and they noticed that what it seemed like is it was kind of lumpy and not too uniform. They started looking out, you know, and it was quite lumpy and not very homogeneous. But they noticed that lumpiness, you know, was kind of there until you get out to 300 million light years. And then all the stuff beyond that seemed to be quite uniform. So they're saying, oh, so I guess it's just a matter of you got to kind of back up enough where, you know, where 300 million light years is kind of small, and then in that big picture, it's the cosmological principle, the godless universe of uniformity. Okay, but what have they really discovered? They've discovered the actual structure of the master universe. Because, yes, the universal expansion and contraction doesn't have a special point, every point, but it's not like the master universe doesn't have a special point. There's a center of symmetry of the whole master universe. When we're sitting here in the Milky Way galaxy looking out at the outer space levels, we're sitting at the center of everything. You know, relative to the size of the second outer space level, I mean, the distance between us and the central universe, you know, you can ignore all that. I mean, it's all just a dot at the center where we're standing. And we're looking at the second outer space level all around us, okay? You know, and it's symmetric about us. We are at a special point. We're very close to the center of all things. We're effectively at the center of all things when you're thinking about the second outer space level.
So if we theoretically had a scope and a good sky and it saw infrared, you know, it would span the whole sky, is what you're saying.
No, what I'm saying is what you observe is a picture where, see, think about what's really happened. What's really happened is those force organizers are out there and they're making galaxies. Okay, and they're spinning them up. And they've basically worked out to 300 million light years. And so you got all these galaxies that they've built out to that level, you know, that have been there for a while. And those galaxies that have been there for a while, they're starting, you know, gravity, they're starting to clump up. You know, there's structures, superclusters and filaments and whatnot. It's all clumpy. But you go beyond that, you go into the outer half of the second outer space level, they're just starting to do stuff out there now. And so it's still pretty much random out there. You know, they're just going to, it's like, well, there's nothing over here, let's start one here. Okay, there's nothing over here, let's start one here. You know, they're basically starting them in a uniform pattern out there. Once they get, you know, spun up and start, you know, they'll start clumping together too, but they haven't had a chance to clump together because they're really, you know, new. And so, so that's what you're really seeing. That's why it appears to go uniform and prove a godless universe out there is because it's being made uniform. And it's clumpy in here, not because you got to get beyond that before you can see the godless universe. It's because it's been there here a while and it started to clump together.
And we have no way of turning around and looking at the center.
We can't even see you know, the first and the sixth galaxies, you know. Okay, but we can see, you notice, did you notice the word here? Or the phrasing? Let's see, where in the heck was that? Blast it, where was it, where they said, oh, here. Right at the beginning of that paragraph. They're fairly reliable when applied to the starry realms belonging to your super universe and the associated super universes. You're like, wait a minute, that's saying I can see something. You can, just a tiny little bit. If you look towards the super universe number one and above the plane of our galaxy, there's a little galaxy that you can see that we don't know, but the revelators tell you is actually in the first super universe. It's not in our super universe. That little galaxy called Barnard's Galaxy is actually, they tell you, in super universe number one. It's just on the other side of the boundary. And you can see it because it happens to be enough above the plane that you can, you know, if you look up over the top of our plane, you can see it there. Okay.
Be up above our horizon, so to speak.
Just above the plane of the galaxy. Yeah. Okay. So that's why that is in there. We can actually can see that one thing in one of the super universes. But we can't see the great big galaxy because our galaxy is in the way. Okay. So what they've actually done here is said that when you get more powerful telescopes, like we finally had in the 90s, you're going to notice this special distance, 300 million light years. And like I said, I mean, exactly that number is what we've stumbled upon ourselves. We've misinterpreted it, but we found it exactly like they told us we would. And then, do you remember what I said when we were reading section two in this paper? I said, they gave you a curious fact up there. They said that in the not-distant future, new telescopes will reveal to the wondering gaze of Eurasian astronomers no less than 375 million new galaxies in the remote stretches of outer space. At the same time, these more powerful telescopes, three words, more powerful telescopes. What are the three words that they gave in this paragraph? You see them there? More powerful telescopes. Those three words occur twice in the book. Okay? Connect the two. Okay? What are they really telling you up here, this mysterious statement, you know, that no less than 375 million new galaxies. So it's like, well, why not 376 or 375, you know, 0.2865. I mean, what? You know, three significant digits? I mean, what on earth? You know, and again, from a modern point of view, it's like, okay, again, some unimaginative person, you know, writing a religious text, you know, thinking they're doing fancy numbers. You know, we think there's billions of galaxies, you know, because we're not just imagining them, and we've observed them. Okay. What this is connected. This is a very important clue to calibrate our methods. Not only have they told you what we, you know, that you're going to discover that basically all of the galaxies that are really developed to any degree are within 300 million light years of you, but they told you how many galaxies there are in that range. There's 375 million galaxies within 300 million light years of. They've told us the number of galaxies even. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, the number of galaxies would have to be related to the number of master architects.
A little bit more than that. I mean, it's more related to how many associate force organizers you have, because those galaxies in the outer space levels are actually, there's still, every galaxy that you see in a telescope picture has associate force organizers there present. That's what they hold it. The architects, what you're thinking of is the number of architects increase as you go to the more levels.
I'm thinking that they would have a domain of so many grand universes.
But just one thing you got to keep in mind there, those are absolute beings, so they're transcendent of the of these finite things.
What are these more powerful telescopes?
Well, just, you know, I mean, just, you know, all the telescopes that use, you know.
Arecibo?
No, Arecibo is a radio telescope.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But like Hubble, Hubble's a good example. Okay. But it's just all the big ground-based telescopes that we started to have in the 90s. Okay. So I mean, that's what that's about. These, you have to put not only the two numbers together to get 300 million. But then you can put the other, the 375 million galaxies. Those are all the same. They're talking about all the same thing. They're telling you that you basically have this developed region that's 300 million light years out, and there's 375 million galaxies in it. Okay. One other little thing. When we look, like, say, in the Hubble Deep Field things, when we see all these galaxies that are massively redshifted, and we assume that they're billions of light years away, okay, that's all false. And kind of related to these, you know, there's lots of errors here. One of the errors that we don't know about is most of that redshift is not due to the expansion contraction. There are no galaxies beyond a billion light years. Like all these galaxies, these billions and billions of galaxies we think are out there, there are no such things. All those galaxies that are massively redshifted are the ones that are in the outer half of the second outer space level. And they're massively redshifted when we observe the photons coming from them, because those photons are not free to just leave that matter, that radiating matter, and journey to us. There's very active presence of associated force organizers in those embryonic galaxies. And those photons have to escape from that presence, draining energy out of them, redshifting them. Okay, so those aren't distance-related, expansion-related redshifts totally. Okay? There are no galaxies in the second, in the third outer space level. Yeah. And you'll kind of see them alluding to that coming up here. Okay, so that's the basic picture that they're trying to correct. I mean, and it matches everything that we've observed if you get rid of the false initial assumptions, you know, like there is no God and things like that.
But the greatest of all such distortions arises because the vast universes of outer space in the realms next to the domains of the seven superuniverses seem to be revolving in a direction opposite to that of the grand universe. That is, these myriads of nebulae and their accompanying suns and spheres are at the present time revolving clockwise about the central creation. The seven superuniverses revolve about paradise in a counterclockwise direction. It appears that the second outer universe of galaxies, like the seven superuniverses, revolves counterclockwise about paradise. And the astronomic observers of Uversa think they detect evidence of revolutionary movements in a third outer belt of far distant space, which are beginning to exhibit directional tendencies of a clockwise nature.
Okay, a couple things. Notice how they're using the word revolutionary, revolve, for this motion around the center of all things in a circuit. Okay. And also, ask yourself, why does it say seem to be revolving in a direction opposite to that of the grand universe? Like we were saying at the beginning, the seven superuniverses are not in Newtonian gravity orbits about the Isle of Paradise at the center. They're not revolving like that. And the ones in this first outer space level seeming to be in Newtonian gravity orbits that are retrograde compared to that. That's why it says seeming. Okay, they seem to be in Newtonian gravity orbits in opposite directions. They're not in that kind of a Newtonian gravity orbit. There's just a uniform motion in one direction or another in those domains, and everything goes with it. Just like there's a uniform outward or inward motion everywhere because of the expansion contraction, and everything goes with it.
It's a motion of space.
Right. It's a motion with the base point of the aisle. Okay. You know, like I said, I mean, you kind of think, you know, there's sort of a flow, and they're all just going with the flow. They're not in Newtonian gravity orbits about the center. Okay, so that's why the seeming is in there. And then So, see, notice what they're saying. So, and the astronomic observers of Eversa think they detect evidence of revolutionary movements in the third outer belt. Okay, okay. They don't mean whirls. They don't mean revolutionary movements like that. How are we using the word? You know, they mean, they think they're starting to see the flow, the direction of the flow out there. Okay, you've got counterclockwise in the super universe, clockwise in the first, counterclockwise in the second, and then clockwise again in the third. And they're, over billions and trillions of years of time, they can watch stuff rattling around in the master universe container, like photons rattling about. And they can do ray tracing, for instance. And they can notice, well, you know, if the photons rattling around in here are going to end up kind of looking like they do, if I backtrack that path, the only way that could be is if when that photon was going through the third outer space level, you know, it was drifting clockwise a bit, and then it got into the second and drifted counterclockwise, and then it got into the first and drifted clockwise, and then it got here and drifted counterclockwise. That's the only, you know, that's what they mean by that. They're starting to detect that things are being caught in a flow out there. But they're not actually just looking at a galaxy out there and watching it, you know, like that, because there aren't any galaxies out there yet. You know, like they're pointing out, the build distance is just 300 million light years. They haven't even built the whole second outer space level, let alone get to the point of starting to build in the third. That's what they're telling you here. Okay, and like I said, we've actually verified that with our own observations, that the build distance is 300 million light years.
When you go out to the outer space levels, because it's a bigger circumference, does the speed increase that it takes to get around?
This is a question that is not, I don't know. I mean, I'm
the speed increases so much?
I don't think so. I think, you know, the whole point is that they're alternating. So, it's not like it has some sort of logic of rotating like a record platter so that the speed would be increasing, like you're saying. So most likely, you know, it's a very slow drift out there. So like in the third outer space level, this probably took them trillions of years of careful measurements. You know, it's like, you know, I think the 12th decimal place shows a little tweaking, you know. Because, you know, how many trillions of years does it probably take something to go around in the third outer space level? It could be an extremely long time. Yeah, okay, time scale.
Well, it calls this the greatest of all such distortions. So are they
talking
about the redshift?
Okay, yeah. So let me just say one little quick thing. I know it's getting late. One little quick thing about that. If you look at really very careful observers and people who are trying to understand the Hubble plot, trying to make that straight line plot of galaxies, you can see that it's really not a straight line. It's two straight lines that are bent at a point. Okay, first outer space level, second outer space level, because of this. See, because obviously there's a big global distortion in those redshifts. Because of these counter flows. You know, if I'm moving around counterclockwise, listen, I'm looking over here, all this stuff is coming at me. See, all that stuff is blue shifted, right? You know, it's going to distort, in general it's red shifted, but those red shifts have been reduced because of the counter movement, you know, and then that flips in the second. And you can actually see that. You know, I've seen some plots where there, you know, it appears like there's two lines, and guess where that bend point is? Right in the middle of the gap between the first and second outer space levels. I mean, so you can even see this in careful plots.
And there's probably a little bit of an answer to Gloria's question in that, because as you were saying, if the analogy was just to a record player, a record going around, and all of the outer space levels were going at that speed, but they're not. They're
lumbering more, I think. Yeah, there's no evidence, you know, that as you start to look out there, you know, there's a screaming distortion. It's not like the curve goes like this. You know, it's just a little kink, you know. Okay, yeah. All right, let's read that last little paragraph there.
It is probable that these alternate directions of successive space precessions of the universes have something to do with the intramaster universe gravity technique of the universal absolute, which consists of a coordination of forces and an equalization of space tensions. Motion as well as space is a complement or equilibrant of gravity.
Now, we basically read that stuff back in the previous paper, but notice one little tweak that he made here. Intramaster universe gravity technique of the universal absolute. Well, reservoirs don't have techniques. Functioning facets of deity have techniques. You know, the infinite upholder has a technique. And when I downstep the infinite upholder to like the absonite upholder, for instance, or the finite upholder, I have what? Mother. What's the word? Consists of a coordination of forces. See, the mother word. Just notice how they're always tweaking that. You know, if you've gotten to the point where you know that the coordination word is used associated to mother deity, see?
What would they mean, though, by equalization of space tensions?
You have, what does the mother do? Coordinate action and cosmic over control. See, the mother is the individuality of the whole, you know, and that this whole bit about keeping the big picture in mind and keeping things coordinated relative to the harmony of the big picture. See, that's what they're talking about. You don't want, you know, if things are getting, you know, too glommed together here, you know, you're working. No, that's not what I wanted to do. That's a tension that's not proper. Let's relieve that tension. Think about, how you sort of directly understand that in the grand universe. What's the actual hand of that cosmic overcontrol of the universal mother? It's the Almighty Supreme. You know, an actual hand that grips and coordinates the big picture. But that's the reaction facet, the action facet that sees that there's over control needed. That's the mother, and the Almighty Supreme reacts to that recognition and does what's needed to control the big picture. The Almighty Supreme is one of the sevenfold controllers.
I was just caught up by the word equalization.
Yeah.
Interesting choice of words. I don't know what else they would have called.
Right. You're just right. You're balancing things to be in harmony. That's the sense of the equalization. It's a sense. Remember, we talked about the difference between equal and equity. Equal is it has the al suffix. It's equity like. Okay. The fundamental thing is the harmony, the cosmic picture. Okay. See.
That makes more sense.
See? Yep. Okay. Well, that's thank you for. Boy, we really went late there, but I told you it was a huge it was a huge section.
Really, but the makes you realize that this couldn't have been written by.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Humans.
Right. Especially. See when you unpack it properly like that. Yeah. Is it not self-evident that this is a revelation?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. The fact, you know, I didn't unpack it like that because I'm a really master storyteller.
Right.
Okay, that's what's there, guys. Okay, this is not written by Bob back in the 20s, okay? Or E. Sadler or anyone else. Okay? No.
But don't you find it curious, the word world and the word world?
No connection.
Yeah, there isn't, but
about the word planet and the
even though there's not a direct etymological connection, there's an interesting kind of around the other side connection that The word world, W-O-R-L-D, and the word universe have a historical association. I mean, really the Latin word that we now use, you know, the universe, was used for the world, too. And when the Revelators use the word world, W-O-R-L-D, they mean, you know, like if it's an inhabited world, they don't just mean the ball of dirt. And that might be the sphere, okay? The world is the whole living system of it. You know, and we know it's a system. There's a one turning to it, to a degree. You know, the word universe literally means one turning. W-I-R-L, a whirl in the force charge. Okay, there is an interesting backdoor connection, even though it's not a direct etymological linkage. So, yeah, coincidentally. All right, let's take a moment here.